All right, well, welcome everybody from around the world. We have folks on Things That Matter this evening as from Taiwan, from Pennsylvania, and all points between. Our theme tonight is really about character counting. And so I just want to point out one person in the audience who's particularly meaningful to me. She is or was married to the late Mel Smith, who was my first real boss in constitutional affairs, and was a man who demonstrated faith, character, principle, and I learned a lot from him. So Beverly Smith, thank you for being in the audience tonight and for inspiring me. You'll be glad you joined tonight's podcast, I think, for three reasons. We've got a great theme, we've got great panelists, and I think you will just find that the chemistry between these panelists is kind of special. So stay tuned. I think you're going to enjoy it. Some have asked how you check in on past podcasts that we've done. You can go to the website, johnwesson.ca. They're also on Spotify and Apple. And I want to point out especially, I think in our audience tonight is Kathy Peters, who was on the last podcast on getting things done in government. So thanks, Kathy, for joining us. And yes, the recording of your show is up and available. Upcoming show. Well, we've got a supercast June 8th. This is about challenges to women in leadership. And we've got Carrie Hessler-Radelet, who was President Obama's choice to lead the Peace Corps for two terms. And two young women leaders, Rose Kamiab, who's going to be a doctor. She's at McGill Medical School, and Mamie Weston, who's now at Harvard. And yeah, you'll have to forgive the last name. There's a little bit of nepotism going on there, but I'm sure you'll enjoy all three of them as they discuss challenges to women in leadership. And by the way, speaking of great women, one who's in the audience tonight is Kate Kirkwood, who is a teacher of really young kids. I'm so pleased that we've got teachers in the audience this evening. If you want to follow us on social media, there's lots of ways to do that. And our team, Dana, Elliot, Amber, and I, we like to say that we don't post often, but we post well. So hopefully it's worth following us on those channels. Well, just before I bring on Dave Phillips and Jonathan Michael, I want to touch on two articles that ran this past week. And one was in the New York Times, and it was about this famed celebrity convict named Elizabeth Thompson. I don't know if you're aware of her. She's the world's youngest self-made billionaire. Her firm was called Theranos, T-H-E-R-A-N-O-S. And she supposedly perfected a way of testing your blood for all sorts of different diseases. And she was the darling of Wall Street and was doing fantastic until it was discovered that she was lying about her product. And she's been convicted of criminal fraud and she's going to jail. So there's somebody who seemed to have it all, at least everything but character. And then another story that was in the New York Times. Another story that ran this week was in the Globe and Mail. And this is by John Ibbotson, who's not renowned to be a fan of the Conservative Party and certainly isn't renowned to be assailing the liberals. And his article is not a partisan piece. What drew me to the article, it's called Chong Deserves Better from Liberal Government. It's a tribute to Member of Parliament Michael Chong, who's been in the news a lot lately with the concern around Chinese government interference in our democracy. But he describes Michael Chong as, quote, perhaps the most principled Member of Parliament in the House of Commons. That's a large tribute when you think of 338 elected public figures. And he singles out Michael Chong. Why? Because Michael has throughout his career consistently made choices that were, well, service above self. And another person in the audience today is Christopher Lote, a great Rotarian. Well, Christopher, you would love Michael Chong's career because, for instance, back in 2006, when Stephen Harper was prime minister, the prime minister suggested that the House pass a resolution that would say the Quebecois are a nation within a unified Canadian government. And Michael said, no, that's not good for the country. He was a cabinet minister. He is the only person I know in Canadian history who gave up his cabinet post on a matter of principle. And he got in trouble with the Chinese government because he brought in a motion that condemned the Chinese government for genocide dealing with the Uyghurs. And so you probably know the story. He and his family have been targeted by the Chinese government and a Chinese diplomat for retribution. So two different persons, two very prominent persons, one known for her magnificent success and another known for his sterling character. And as we delve into tonight's show, we can ask ourselves, you know, who do we want to be? Well, one person I would like to be is Jonathan Michael, who has for over 20 years been a teacher, an activator and mentor of world-class leaders. He is certified as a job and career development coach. He does have a dubious distinction, though, and I don't know if I should reveal this. He won the prestigious Governor General's Gold Medal at Trinity Western University, a distinction which he shares with none other than the former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. So I guess that's running in good company for many. And forgive my little shot at... Jonathan, you're very distinguished, and it's great to have you on board. And you come with Dave Phillips, who is another remarkable human being, a business owner, a board member, an author, columnist. And I can't resist pointing this out. He holds the two Guinness Book records for duration of snow skiing and water skiing. Now, who do you know who would want to even think about being on the snow for 87 hours or in the water for 57 hours? He did it. And a Olympic gold medalist, Kathy Kreiner, married him anyway. So we have Dave Phillips. So both of you, really, really looking forward to your comments. I'm going to throw out a question and sort of get out of the way. We live in an era where diversity and inclusion are watchwords for how we govern our boards, how we govern our country. How do we serve diversity and inclusion when those factions seem sometimes at war with one another? And how does that relate to character? So I don't know which of you wants to jump in first on that one.
I'm going to let Dave talk about that, John. Thank you for the introduction of both of us. And Dave, why don't you go with that?
Well, Jonathan, you're the smartest guy I know. I'm one of them. And so I think I would normally defer to you. Well, let me just start by saying that, you know, I just see a lot of people talking these various factions, and there's no one who wants to be honoring more of these. I think we all want to be honoring of people's personal choice. I just don't think we have a language that that really creates a foundation for the conversations. And so you end up with the various, you know, these various groups kind of basically kind of fighting for airspace. And in some cases that I've witnessed, not necessarily addressing one another kindly. And, you know, it's my great sense that we have capacity as humans to treat one another well, even with those people who we disagree with, whether it's a diversity and inclusion issue, whether it's a political party issue, whether it's an issue around philosophy or how we raise our kids. I think we need to develop a common language where we can show great respect and at the same time hold strong opinions that might be different.
What do you think, Jonathan?
I think that's great. You know, I mean, what Dave is talking about is this cultivation of excellence. And, you know, Dave and I very agreed on that. And, you know, one of the things that This goes back a long time. Human beings have been talking about these for a long time, but all of our societies have certain values and virtues that we really think are important. It's what matters most, how to treat one another. Even the ancients had laws of war of how do you treat a prisoner or a prisoner of war? How do you treat another person with respect? You know, when Alexander the Great came to India and won the battle, he asked the king who lost to him, how would he like to be treated? And the king said, I'd like to be treated like a king. And Alexander went on to do that. But this idea of respect between even enemies of, you know, for example, the sacredness of those who were heralds, you know, the Spartans killed the heralds, which is why they had, you know, supposed to be very impious towards the gods, and even the Greeks agreed with that. So those ideas of virtue, of humility, compassion, kindness, those things are really, you know, just an expansion of what Dave is already talking about.
Well, it's interesting. You're talking about conflicts and war, and One of the persons in our audience today is my friend Yuri from Ukraine. And, you know, he's teaching me a lot about how to deal with forgiveness and compassion and things like that. So those are aspects of character. And by the way, folks in the audience, feel free to send your questions through the chat line, and I'll do my best to bring them to our panelists' attention. I think a lot about this and what it means for our culture and our society and our character. In fact, I chair an organization called the Canadian Health and Fitness Institute, and our goal, among other things, is to get people outdoors, get them off their screens and doing exercise for their physical, mm-hmm. mental, and spiritual health. So we talk about this thing often in the context of our addictive behaviors and how we live in an addictive culture. So let me ask you this. If you don't have this container of character required to withstand the force of our addictive culture, then how will the forces unleashed by the internet or by aspects of our culture today deal with us? I'm going to go to you first. No, you went first, Dave. We'll go with you, Jonathan.
Yeah, so just repeat that, you know, quote that you had mentioned before about being the container, and just say that one more time.
Well, okay, if you don't have the container of character required to withstand the force of this addictive culture, how will those forces treat you, these forces like the internet and social media?
Well, this is the idea of, you know, building and developing character that, you know, Aristotle in his work on ethics and morality, which is kind of a classic, and even, you know, philosophers and psychologists are kind of going back to that now, because and more is written on this idea of virtue ethics, is this idea of kind of balance about the mean. For example, courage is a virtue, but if you have what's called too much courage, it's seen as kind of an addiction for recklessness. Right? And if you don't have enough courage, then you're, you know, moved by fear. So it's just building that mean. So the idea is having balance, because the goal of this whole idea of virtue and character was to live a life of flourishing, to be able to flourish. And so when we are addicted to something, you know, or someone or whatever it is, we are not flourishing. So the idea of virtue is to actually to be able to flourish, to build up strength, to be able to flourish. I'm going to stop with that and let Dave go on anything he wants to say.
Yeah, because you're leaving me a little bemused. I'm thinking, if I'm 25 years old and I'm watching this podcast tonight, and I'm thinking, wow, Jonathan, what a cool guy. And he just said there's something like too much courage, and I don't know how to deal with that. But anyway, let's go over to you, Dave, and we can come back, Jonathan, if you want to review that.
Sure.
Yeah, I feel a little like we've got Beauty and the Beast here. You know, Jonathan has got this beautiful historical view from, you know, from ethics and Aristotle and from history and from all that's happened. You know, I feel like the guy who lives in the street with people who are facing these issues, you know, all the time. And frankly, you know, I've been accused maybe of being, given to reductionist oversimplification for the case of practical application. And, you know, and I think, you know, it's almost as before we talk about these things, we need to just think about all of history and the character values that have served every race, class, color, creed, sexual orientation, family background, you know, everyone everywhere, essentially. You know, and so these, once we understand that there is actually a description of character, I think it gives us a much better place to start. In fact, I just happen to have some cards that I'm going to be using for an exercise, but things like unity and wisdom and transcendence and goodness and, you know, and courage and compassion. I mean, these essentially are the timeless character values that we ascribe to our character, who we want to be described as at our funeral. It is actually completely separate to what we do, yet it informs everything we do. And can we actually focus on the character values and start to help people understand not just what they do, but who they really, really are and who they really want to be, who they want their children to be, who they want their coworkers to be? And can we give them tools and practical ways of understanding this little tiny list of somewhere between 18 and 24 words? Via character would say 24. They've done the best research, I think.
So now I think you're getting somewhere with my fictitious but not so fictitious 25-year-old person who's in the audience right now. I'm thinking of several as we speak. And I'm going to jump the gun a little bit because later in the show, we're going to talk about some of your favorite picks in terms of books and things. But there's a pair of books by David Brooks that come up later. We'll be talking about those. He talks about your resume values versus your character values. And the resume values are more about what Elizabeth Thompson demonstrated. She was a great speaker. She's really smart. She went to Stanford. She was disciplined and hardworking, right? So in many cases, you'd say, oh, you'd hire that person in a minute. But there wasn't the character values. And you've written a book, Dave, and I don't have it, but Jonathan, can you pull up Dave's book or Dave, if you, there you go.
Yeah.
So this book is really useful. It's called Three Big Questions. And in that, you go through some of these things, right? And you help people identify them. And if I'm 25 wondering what in the world I'm going to be when I grow up, it's not a bad start to say, go forward 50 or 60 years and think where I want to finish and then work backwards. And that's, I think, what you were just talking about. Did I do justice to your thought?
Yeah. There's so much to be said, John, but you know, the great confusion and the thing that makes me a little bit crazy about the schools is that they are telling young people that they should choose their most important values and then go live their lives according to that. Well, at the time of life, which they're choosing those, I liked it when I was 20 or 25 years old, I liked to water ski and snow ski and travel. Whew, I'm going to build my life on that, right? And well, hang on just a minute, actually. Those are what I would call activity values. But you see, then you do that for a little while, you get a little older and you realize, oh, I kind of need some competency values. What am I good at? What do I value? What does the world value in me? What can I do? And so then you start thinking about that. Most people, to be honest, kind of get stuck there, and that's where our culture is kind of stuck. And really, at the end of the day, they come back to character values when they start having children, when they start running businesses or working in teams, and they are trying to think about how is it that we treat one another, what informs this social discourse that we have with one another. I mean, I get quite animated about this because, of course, this is such an important thing to think about.
Okay, so I'm going to throw this to you, Jonathan. I heard Dave say that it's really important to develop these character values, but it's not likely you're going to do it until you're well into your life. Wouldn't it be an advantage if you could start thinking about those things when you're also developing those competency values he's talking about? So in other words, do we have to wait till we're 50 to work on the character values, or how do we encourage young people to look to a Michael Chong instead of Elizabeth Thompson as their role model?
Well, I think Dave would agree with me that says that character and those values are shaped also by our environment, family, society, and things like that. But what Dave is talking about is this intentional chasing after it, which is very, very different. So, for example, you know, when John, when your daughter is running marathons or running or, you know, playing a sport, we talk about building character. Those are those character virtues that Via talks about, like perseverance, grit, courage, things like that. So it's shaped. But what Dave is talking about, taking the extra step of being very thoughtful about it, but being self-reflective about it, and then being intentional about how you shape that container. And I, it used to be something that was important in society. I mean, Stephen Covey, who wrote the kind of the best business book of, you know, the last century or whatever, with Seven Habits, he talked about the personality ethic which, when he studied 200 years of success literature, the first 150 years of success literature was oriented around character. Build your character, learn to work hard, get grit, get courage, be honest, be hardworking, you know, keep your word. But after that, it was oriented towards the social mirror. How do you look? Make sure you have the right image. You look good. You know, you got the right stylist. Your spin doctors say the right thing to the media, right? So there's a vast difference between
that. In Elizabeth's case, it was wear the black turtleneck. That was part of her shtick.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, you know, you talk about perseverance and grit, and forgive me if I cut you off in mid-thought. Did I, or had you finished your...
Yeah. It's just the difference between image and identity. Our world that we are at right now is very, very interested in image. What do I look like on Facebook? Who has more likes to me? It's not, we aren't into the internal, like, who am I? Who do I want to be? How do I want to act? Right? The unexamined life, it's just based on externals in the social mirror. That's all I want to say about that. Whoa, between image and identity. Yeah.
Set up so beautifully. My next question, by the way, the US Surgeon General has just come out with a really astounding report. The latest pandemic, he says, is loneliness. And he talks about how hurtful it is for people to dwell in the world of social media, where they're constantly comparing themselves against superior images, which are doctored, unreal, artificial, fake images. And yet, if you're comparing yourself against them, you automatically feel bad, inferior, deficient, low in self-esteem. Interesting. So I'm going to tread across a line here. I know both of you are men of faith. And this is a world where we don't always talk about our faith in public life. I know that from my role as a parliamentarian. I never denied my faith, but it wasn't necessarily a welcome topic. So how do you relate, and Jonathan, you just talked about the different cultural and other things that frame character. How does your faith and your character relate? And can you have character without faith? And what difference does it make? And you only have, 13 seconds to answer the question.
Yes. And yes. Well, I'll make 3 points about that. Number one, yes, it's important because my faith, as a Christian, has shaped me, recognizing that I grew up in a community of many other religions, and all of those other religions share common virtues and values of faith. Islam has an idea of compassion, and Buddhism has this idea of compassion. Then that same idea of compassion is in the Bible, the idea of humility, the idea of keeping your word, truth-telling. Those are all important things. They were shaped by, drank the Bible with my mother's milk, so to speak. So I learned many of those proverbs with pride going before a fall. So those shaped, who I am, and they become kind of helped me shape that moral compass, that I choose for myself. So.
Okay. Interesting. Dave.
Oh boy.
That's not a good start.
We sometimes forget the foundation of our faith. We sometimes forget we focus too much on activity values or competency values, and we don't focus on character values, what they are and how they practically are lived out in our lives. And it would be my great hope that people of faith would be able to take a look at the foundational character values and make decisions and live their lives based on those. I mean, you can, in fact, it's very interesting if you cross the hall between the theists and the atheists. Everyone agrees in a series of character values that is common to the human condition. Atheists would say it's a description of the character and the nature of Christ. And the atheists would simply say that these were the list of character values we needed to develop so that we could create civil societies and develop systems of justice and order. And so it doesn't really matter whether you are a theist or an atheist. There is this common language that we can create So that we don't create a sort of a discussion that creates separation. We can start with a common a discussion about our various faith perspectives from a place of unity, not separation, whether that's diversity and inclusion or our faith or differences in business.
Well, I'm just thinking of one person in the audience, Ken, who lives a life that is demonstrably about service. He has at the church I used to attend fostered something called divorce care for ages. And he doesn't care what is the faith of the person who comes to the, he would call it his service. Some would call it a ministry, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you can follow the breadcrumbs. Why is he doing these things? Oh, well, he's a person of faith who activates his faith into those kinds of things. I think there are people like that who are clearly influenced heavily by their faith, and that influences their character. You both have been throwing out some of the classical philosophers. One of my favorites is Augustine, who mentions the eight sins, right? The deadly sins, which is maybe the flip side of character. And he talks about sloth, lust, anger, pride, envy, greed, and gluttony, if I've got them right. Mm-hmm. And surprise. Maybe it's
memorized.
Yeah, I do have an acronym in my head, so that's my secret. But I think it's useful sometimes when you're talking about character to talk about anti-character. So you know, you have some context, and Augustine does that brilliantly, of course. Okay, so we've talked about faith, and you did magnificently well, by the way, providing us some coherent answers in a short time, and you could easily fill hours on that, I know. Let's talk about love.
Oh,
well, why not? We've talked about faith, and my wife is in the audience, Donna, and so I know she's going to be at least as interested as I am in your answer to this question. So does character influence how we love?
I'm going to let Dave answer that because it's his mission statement. His mission statement is all about love.
Love is one of the most misunderstood words in our culture. And so I love Brené Brown and her definition. I love all of the philosophers, all of the people who talk about love. These are fabulous and heartwarming, romantic, beautiful descriptions of what love is. However, it doesn't really give our young people or our culture any practical instructions on how to love. And so if I could permit to step way, way above my pay grade and give you my definition of love, and I welcome any pushback on this, but I believe that love truly is a mystical, unitive, generative force. It truly is mystical. We don't understand it. Unitive, it pulls us together. Generative, creates families, builds cultures, right? It's this wonderful force, right? But beyond the mystical side, it is also and this is what we need to be teaching our young people about how to practically love. It is the balanced application of these higher values in relationships with people and planets. If we do not understand these higher values of love and justice and humility and grace and so on, and if we do not understand how to apply them in our relationships, we will be in trouble. And there is a way, there's common language around these things. If we look around, if we go to viacharacter.org, we can actually start to learn how to apply these in a practical sense. I have a daughter, 28 years old, and I say to her, dear, if a young man comes to you and says, I love you, the first question you should ask him is, what do you mean by that? It's not very romantic, but it's absolutely a valid question.
Okay. Can you help us out here? What is viacharacter.org? And I have another question from what you said, but first tell us more about what is viacharacter.org?
Well, Via Character is, I mean, I'll try to make a long story short here, but there's been Martin Seligman, who is the youngest president of the American Psychological Association, probably the father of this notion of positive psychology that you've been hearing so much about. You know, he has been working with a guy named Neil Meyerson in Cincinnati, and they have launched this thing called Via Character about 20 years ago, where they scanned every culture and religion, every place you could go to, tribes in the Serengeti, and they would say, what are these values that everyone agrees on, separate to culture, religion, and so on? And they came up with this list of 24 values, and this is probably the best research that I have ever seen, that can take and describe, can test you for free, by the way. You can take a free test, and you can get a list of your top five. And there's no wrong answer, but it gives you a chance to talk through these in relationships with people who are important to you. It doesn't matter if it's your executive team or your children. They're very important that you talk through and say, what do these mean in our relationship? And how does it set the expectations that we will have to inform our behaviors in terms of how we treat one another? Because they represent this place of character. And Via Character, incidentally, if you go to viacharacter.org, you can actually take a free questionnaire. 30 million people have taken it, 3 million of them last year. It is so important to our development as people, I think.
Well, and I know Jonathan is champing at the bit, but yeah, hold on for
one
second.
I get all excited, Jonathan.
No, I know you are, and I'm glad you are. You talked about applying these virtues in relationships. So again, I like it that you have a daughter who's how old?
28.
28. Okay. So I want you to envision her or someone in their 20s as you answer this question. You talked about applying these virtues in relationships. So does that mean you can support other people who are trying to nurture good characteristics? It's a loaded question because I really am about promoting goodness in leaders. And I've seen a lot of mediocrity or badness in leaders. And so I'd love to think that what you're talking about here can lead young people to search out really good virtues and then encourage those to flourish. How do you think about that?
Well, I think a good many things about that. Jonathan, would you like to start or would you like me to?
Well, you know, there's a few things that can be said about that, right? You know, how do we cultivate virtue? First of all, just to touch on what you said already, John, you talked about virtue and relationships. And virtue is always connected to relationships. One aspect of the relationship is our relationship to self. So there's some virtue that have to do with how do you relate to ourselves? Well, how do I think about myself? Do I think of myself more highly than I ought to or to less than I ought to? So this sense of self. So how do I relate to myself? Also the issue of self-control, what the ancients called temperance, having temperance. So there are virtues that have to do with myself. But many of the virtues then have to do with others, because even when you have self-control, when Johnny is told, don't eat all the hot dogs, it has to do with self-control, but it also has to do with leave some for your sister, right? So virtue has to do with those you know, two arenas. How do we cultivate them? Well, you know, virtue is also cultivated in by failing a lot and doing some self-examination. I think that's the one thing that maybe people don't have time to do. To take a look at ourselves, like Peter Frampton sang in the 60s or whatever, take a look at yourself. When you take a look at yourself, you start to examine yourself, you do some self-reflection and this self-awareness and recognize what you're failing at and says, well, who do I want to be? Now, Dave has written a whole book about this idea of purpose, which is deeply connected to this. And hopefully at some point of time, he'll share about that. But I think the idea is defining who do I want to be? And then what are the things I need to do? What behaviors shape me? Because we believe something and we behave that way, and that behaving changes us. If we behave in a certain way consistently, we become that.
Okay, I'm gonna just imagine what my wonderful kids, Shane, Jake, or Mamie, all in their 20s, would say about this conversation. They'd say, those are nice guys. They're your friends, Dad. We like them. But this is a little airy-fairy for me. I mean, what are some specific routines that people should incorporate into their lives to develop good character? And I'm going to ask you each to give me two or three examples of good routines that can measurably lead to improving in your character so that you have a more, to use your word, flourishing life. Dave.
If you were to take either a person or an executive team, and you would say, as I have, and this is a practical example, I'll let you guess whether it's an executive team or a person, and say, what are these important character values? So in this particular case, humility was chosen. Ah, humility. Well, what is humility? We need an operating principle that's humility. So humility is, you know, in this one particular group said, I've got your back. So in other words, I'm not thinking about myself, a principle that I'm going to actually operate by in my life is that. And then a practice comes from that, right? And a practice is where we actually will practice thinking of others, like Jonathan said, saving the hot dog for your sister or whatever, or serving others in some way. And there are practical things that you can do. This is the story of character formation since the beginning of recorded history. You choose a central character value, and hopefully you don't have to get bonked over the head to learn it, as we did some ways, I guess, and different people would say. But it can turn into a practice that then can then turn into a discussion, because we're pack animals. We need to talk about these things with one another. And they can't be, honestly, they can't necessarily be developed in a test tube. They have to be tested against culture in relationships to build harmony amongst couples and families and businesses and executive teams. But it's really a very simple process.
Okay, I'm 20 something years old and I understand vaguely what you're telling me. I know I have to go out and earn a living. I'd like to save money to buy a house. I'm interested in marrying somebody, maybe having a family. And these three dudes on the podcast are telling me I have to develop character. So what do I do tomorrow? What's the what are the routines in my life that help build character?
So let me be quite blunt. The younger people are, the less likely they are going to pay attention to this, because they are worried about building their castle. They're not worried about character. And if it did not happen in their family, they're going to have a challenge. And so the challenge is to young people who this is new news to say, like, you can choose. All of history is telling us this is a pathway that actually works and it will change your life for the better. It will avoid the divorce. And by the way, the 63%, depending on divorce rate, whichever one you listen to, if you'd like to avoid that, if you would like to have lasting relationships, if you would like to actually be known in business as a person people could stand to be around and who you could lead, if you want to be a person who's going to build a good reputation, if you want to have good standing in culture, if you want to have a successful life, pay attention. Now, go ahead, ignore everything I've said at your peril. I learned every one of these gray hairs, and most of them by making a lot of these mistakes. And I wish we could save people from having to make so many of the mistakes that I've made, John.
Okay, I'm going to go to Jonathan, but you're not off the hook. Dave Phillips, I want you to spell out something specific that I can do. So I'm coming back to you, but Jonathan, what do you have in mind? What are some specifics you recommend?
I'll give you one. Okay. I'll give you one. You know, Dave casually mentioned that the ancients were known for self-examination. Benjamin Franklin, you know, wrote, you know, his list of virtues, and how do I do that? I think that for most people who are developing character, they have some kind of practice of thinking about how they are acting and how they want to act or how they want to be. Some kind of reflective exercise. Now, whether people have it as prayer or journaling or however they want to do it, they need to have some kind of practice. Two kinds of practices. One is individual practice. Right. So thinking about myself and says, you know, I failed at that. I should have told the truth. I need to go back and ask this person forgiveness, whatever. So in terms of self-examination, right? The second thing is what Dave talked about, the importance of community. You know, who will I be accountable to? You know, who can challenge me with the hard questions of my life? Who will I cultivate around me? You know, who are the people who will hold me accountable, right? And one of the things I tell people, and Dave knows this about, you know, young people, both have been involved in mentoring lots of young people. The only time they're going to listen is when they have pain in their life, when they feel betrayed, when they lose and things like that. And those are, you know, learning moments. That's, people learn about these things mostly not by some inspiring speaker who's brilliant. They don't. They usually learn it when they lose something, they lose a relationship, they have a terrible accident, or, you know, God forbid that these things happen. But it seems that those kind of disasters actually get people to do self-examination, where you're in a cast lying in a hospital or whatever, or you've been told that, you know, you have cancer or whatever. All of a sudden, you start doing self-reflection. Well, a better time to do it is before those things happen. But it doesn't happen usually. That's the bad news.
I heard a term tonight for the first time. I probably are going to get it wrong, but I think you said something about existential oversimplification, Dave. So I'm going to dive into existential oversimplification. I'm going to throw out four things that I think are specific enough that a 25-year-old can maybe digest them and then reject them or accept them. One is journal. You alluded to this, Jonathan. I think journaling allows you to trace your own trajectory and occasionally even go back and see how it's going. And you can be totally honest because presumably no one's reading it but you. Second, and this is a little vaguer, but your choice of friends. I recall reading in a Maclean's editorial decades ago, one of the best things you could do is choose to surround yourself with persons who can influence your life positively. And I recall when I was a member of parliament, I had the great fortune of having three guys in my life who were the so-called three wise men, and they were there to make me accountable to them on character issues. It was explicit. It wasn't about getting promoted into cabinet. Other people were worrying about my political life. These three guys, Will Johnston, Dave Collins, and Bill Lee, were funny, smart, humble, and confidential. And so they were fantastic. What a resource. I often thought, what a secret weapon I had that my fellow parliamentarians didn't have. Third thing is reading great literature. So I love running into people, and you both fall into this category, who can actually refer to great thinkers and people who've gone before, whose thoughts have been tried and tested. And you probably even have lists of things you want to read. And some would even guess that maybe, Jonathan, you've read most of the books in the shelves behind you, which is pretty amazing, having great books. And then this one is one, if you kind of adopt it into your routines, it can serve you really well, although it's awkward. Correct someone who introduces you in a flattering but wrong way. So there have been occasions where I've been introduced as a Rhodes Scholar or as a Harvard Law graduate. Well, I did almost get a Rhodes Scholarship, and I did go to Harvard, but I didn't go to the law school. I went to the undergrad. So it matters if you correct someone. You say, well, thank you for saying that, and that was a nice comment, but no, I didn't actually do that. I think it's important because it suggests that truth matters, and you're not going to just let it slide because it flatters you. So those are four specific things that I think that a person can start inculcating into life. But those are just my ideas. Any more thoughts on this about specific routines?
Well, one, I would say, address failure. I don't think we value, you know, in North America, you guys really value success a lot. But success and failure are only feedback mechanisms. And I think we learn more from failure than from success. And we can learn from success too, but learning from failure, learning how to have a model or a template and learn from specific failure, right? And I think having a practical model, like how do you learn from a failure? First, you identify that failure and name it as a failure. We're also easy to put blame on others. And that's the first start. It says, own it, right? and then being able to describe it and our feelings and our thoughts at that point of time. And then, you know, after we have done that, move forward to identify how that failure gives value to us. What can I learn from that, right? And then what do I do different from that? So this word that we don't like, this F word that we don't like, failure, we need to learn to love it and embrace it, because it's one of the greatest teachers we can have in our life.
Did you just say, if you can meet triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same?
Oh, you're the poet. You can go ahead and quote it.
Yeah, the discerning listener will know that was Rudyard Kipling. That wasn't me. But
yeah, he only got that because he lived in India, you know.
I thought you might say that. I once heard a great speech by an accomplished marathoner who was asked after his talk, how do you deal with hills? And he says, I hate hills. But when I hit one, I say, hello, hill, I've been waiting for you. And what a great metaphor. Oh, failure. That didn't work out so well. Hello, failure, I've been waiting for you. And then lean into it and say, what am I going to learn from that? That is not human nature, but if you can cultivate that characteristic, then you will manage the hills and the failures so much better. Dave.
It is better, I think, John, to act your way into a better way of feeling than to try to feel your way into a better way of acting. Habits and practices become character, and the types of habits and practices we engage will turn into character, and this will build a resilience to the onset of these unavoidable things that challenge us. And so the failures that we have will be failures worth the trouble of having, rather than dealing with so many minor failures and being stuck in them. We never get to the major, the things that really should cause us to really press ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about practical things, John, these personal practices that you talk about are all important. Journaling and, you know, journaling at the end of the day, looking at the beginning of the day, you know, so many of these personal practices, like, you know, essentially our limbic system is running our life. So the historical practice of fasting, we're teaching our limbic system it's not in control. I mean, these are practical things that we can try that have this impact on our character. You know, if I could suggest another one, a steady reminder of courage and of grace and humility show up in my task list every day. It just pops up in my task list. I have to read it every day. I need humility because I have not necessarily been known as being a humble person, and I am working on that in my character. And so I have to focus on it. I have to pay attention to it. I have to think about it every day. I've been thinking about it for 30 years. I wish I could say I'm improving. But the very point is that how is it that we have goals for business. We do not necessarily have goals for our character. And if the simplest thing people could do, honestly, was trust the remarkable research done by Via Character. Take that free questionnaire at viacharacter.org. Simply take a look at your top three or top five character values and think, how can I look at these daily? How can I develop practices that will shape my character and build a resiliency to the difficult things of life that will come along?
Jonathan, you paid a big tribute to Covey. Another business author I like is Jim Collins, who wrote Good to Great and
Built to Last.
Thank you. Yeah, and he says that when you're naming values, if you have more than three or four, then they're no longer values because they're diluted. In your book, Dave, you talk about having many, many values. What do you think about Collins' comment that they're diluted and therefore not so important anymore if you get beyond three or four?
I think that when we consider character values, we will have one value that over time we will ascribe a great sense of meaning. In other words, we could pick courage and we could actually have many of the other virtues or higher values actually feed in to help describe that.
That's right.
And so it's not like we lose all the others when we focus on three, but to focus on the three and maybe two, maybe one, whatever, but some small number to provide something we can hang on, something simple. We're simple creatures.
Yeah,
I am. Jonathan, maybe not so much.
Well, Jonathan, you touched on something I think is really important. You talked about perseverance and grit, and you referred to sport. I'm just at the very end of Boys in the Boat, the Daniel Brown book about the 1936 Americans who go and against all odds win the gold medal in Berlin. Do you want to just comment a little bit about the physical disciplines that come with sport and how that relates to character? That's very much what the book is about.
Yeah. Well, sport is such an amazing way and a gift to teach. I think even the arts are also another way. So I don't want to be just this jock thing about sports, but any kind of activity outside the classroom and the theoretical classroom for kids is a vital shaper of character. You know, you learn how to work with a team. You learn how to have humility. It's not all about you. You learn to not to quit, to have, you know, grit. You know, you learn to be gracious in victory, gracious in defeat. All of those things are, you know, powerful. It's a powerful space to actually teach character and virtue.
Yeah, and thank you. You said that really, really well.
And these are things that Jonathan, who has mentored my son, Nelson, has taught him. And actually underneath that nice coat is actually a weightlifter. He can lift a whole bunch more weight than I can in the gym. So don't be deceived. But, you know, these lessons do come out at times like that when we are pressing our physical presence into ways that we never otherwise would have.
Let me say that under my coat is nothing that will deceive you at all. So, and I'm glad you mentioned the arts as well. One of our audience members, in fact, one of the producers of the show, is Dana Powell, who is a professional musician.
Yeah.
And she will tell you that the disciplines cultivated there are very core to her character, and her character affects her musicality.
I mean, you learn practices and habits. You know, for example, you learn time management if you're if you're an athlete. You learn how to manage time if you're a musician. How much time are you going to practice scales and things like that, and do the things that are boring. You know, we live in a world where, you know, give me something that's exhilarating, right? But a lot of the things you do as an athlete, and Dave knows, he's an elite athlete, you do them again and again and over again, and they're boring.
Mm.
But, you know, if you, you know, my son who's into jiu-jitsu says, you know, if you sweat in practice, then you don't have to sweat so much in competition, right? Mm-hmm. If you do your homework, if you, you know, you do your work, you do your homework. And I think we need to teach people that, and we need to find that space to do that. And sport is a good place. Music is a good place. Any kind of discipline where people are learning a craft.
Can we get, and Dave, you're an elite athlete, so can I get you to aim your remarks at those of us who are not elite athletes? We live in an era when sedentary behavior is the new smoking, when a third of our youth are overweight or obese, which means they have 14 times the likelihood of a cardiac event by age 50, where we spend $8 billion of taxpayers' money each year treating unnecessary health conditions relating to sedentary behavior, character and physical exercise. How has that been exemplified in your life?
I mean, I think that they're so intimately connected. You know, sport's just a metaphor. You know, I do this behavioral testing, and in the behavioral testing, we can see actually people do not necessarily need to be competitive in a particular sport. I'm actually not that competitive, but I'm drawn by the things that I love to do. And everyone has something that they love to do. And so, you know, why is it that, you know, and there's many reasons why people struggle with pressing for achieving at a world class, but why is it that we can't move in the direction of doing something that we never thought was possible? You know, people would ask us before the crazy, stupid marathons, how do you know you can do that? And I go, well, we don't actually. We're going to do something. And, you know, they really made me you know, intimately acquainted with my really naive stupidity at that age. You know, because really they were very crazy things to do, John. I mean, honestly, right? I mean, they really were. But you know, we were young; we didn't know any better. We wanted to raise money for a charity, and so you know, away we went. Yeah. But you know, the reality is that you learn so much by pressing yourself physically or into some pursuit that you love, whether it's art or music or whether it's business or a good many other things. Everyone has something that they can achieve at a level of excellence that will express their signature strengths in a meaningful way to do a good thing and create value for humanity. I have just seen it too much to not believe that.
I was downtown Vancouver just yesterday when the BMO Marathon, Vancouver Marathon, was launched. That was started decades and decades ago by Dr. Jack Taunton, who with me founded the Canadian Health and Fitness Institute. And you just saw the energy in the air. You know, these were not elite athletes. Some of them were great athletes for sure, but these are just people who wanted to get out and move and feel good, and they like the outdoors. And so if that grabs you, by the way, I'll beat the drum for our charitable foundation. It's called Canadian Health and Fitness Institute, chfi.fit. We love people who want to come along and help us make Canada the fittest nation on earth by 2030. That's the mantra. But I risk going down a rabbit hole. Let me ask you one more thing, and then we're going to get to one of my favorite parts of the show, which is where you present your picks about other resources. Can character be taught? You've both been dancing around this topic all night. Can you teach character, or is it something that just comes when you're born? And this is really important, right? Because maybe that fictitious, not fictitious 20-plus-year-old person who's out there in the audience today thinking, these guys, they've been through life, they've written books or given speeches about this, but can you teach it? Can you learn character?
Well, I think the quick answer is yes, but that's complicated, right? The earlier in your life, I believe, you know, the nature nurture argument, right? 80, 20, 50, 50, 70, 30. I mean, you know, in my view, there is a genetic component to who we become in the world, and we do have natural predispositions associated with that. The forces that are moved upon us as we grow, I think, change, whether that's 50-50, 70-30. So I think it's a floating line, but I do believe that the younger we can teach character, the more this will be brought out. You know, John, I was once in the presence of a wonderful woman. Her name was Evie, and she was, at the time I was speaking with her at a YPO event here in Vancouver, she was in her mid-80s, I think. She was a Holocaust survivor, had watched her family murdered by the Nazis. And she was going on and on about how this group of people were all these wonderful people, essentially, you know, how they were, you know, icons of virtue and culture. And I said, well, you know, yeah, although that's true, you know, how can you make a statement about that? They're not always like that, Evie. So how can you say that? And she says, oh, David, she put her hand in my hand like this and my forearm. And she says, oh, David, she says, I know that. But sometimes we have to call it out of them. And I believe that I get goosebumps as I tell the story, because here is a woman who would have every reason to hate, yet she has chosen love, and she has chosen to call human goodness from people, from leaders. She has chosen, at 80 years old, she has the belief that people can be changed, that their characters can be formed, that the world can become a better place as a result of these character-based initiatives.
How are you going to respond to that Ebullian optimism, Jonathan?
Well, a couple of things. I'm going to talk about the dark side of that. Okay. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said that the line of evil runs right through the human heart. Mm-hmm. Right. We get to make a choice. Think of your kids. Your kids were not, you know, I mean, we might have great ideas about how wonderful and beautiful our kids are. But think about your kids for the first few years of their life. They're egoistic. They're selfish. They're greedy. They're impulsive. When we think of bad dictators and stuff like that, guess what? They're like those kids. They're ego-driven, they're selfish, they're greedy. That's where their money's in Swiss bank accounts, while the kid hoards all the food under his bed or whatever, and takes his brother's candy, you know, whatever it is. within us is this capacity to both for good, like this lady sought to call out of people, but also terrible evil. And it's not out there in someone else. It's within us, as, you know, in The Hobbit, you know, it's not, as Gandalf says, you know, it's not the times that are upon us, it's the choices we make in those times. And so I think, yes, it's nature and nurture, it's both of them, but ultimately we get to choose. But we have to know that we are capable of being monsters. Not Hitler is capable of being a monster. Dave, my wonderful, loving, most loving friend I know, is capable of being a monster, and so am I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Recognizing that gives us a sense of humility and gives us a healthy fear of being kind of gods to our own self. And that's why having other people speak into our life, having role models and other things that we haven't talked about, but that's, here ended the lesson.
No, that's powerful. That's really, really powerful. You remind me of the most memorable lecture I ever heard in university. It was Comparative Government, Gov 20, Harvard, 1978. And Karl Deutsch was the professor. And this very austere prof who authored the text that we had to buy, he ended his course in describing the most challenging question on the lips of young German kids in the 1970s, which was, "Daddy, what did you do during the war?" And then he started crying and walked off. It was unbelievable. His point was that who are we to say that we would have done something different? Because as you said, and Solzhenitsyn said, the power of evil is within us as well as good, and we get to choose, but it takes some work. On that note, you have provided some books, movies, resources for people who want to go deeper. So let's start with you, Dave. We've got what I call panelist picks. See if we can get that up on the screen.
Oh, good, because I've forgotten which list I gave you. There's so many good ones.
Let's see. I
probably listed David Brooks' The Road to Character might have been one.
Okay, there we go. There's Dave's.
Oh, there's Dave's. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The Road to Character by David Brooks, The Quest for Character. You know, I mean, talking about, you know, the ancient leaders. I mean, you know, The Power of Character Strengths by Ryan Nemec. This is going to be a little bit more, I think, of a technical description with a lot more depth for those people who like to do that. But, you know, I think that, you know, Ryan Nemec was one of the head researchers with, they may be the head guy with, via character, and has done the work and traveled the world talking about this. And The Power of Character Strengths is a wonderful description of, understanding what the character strengths are, about how they work, how you can apply them. You know, The Road to Character, a little bit more anecdotal, but still very motivating to understand and reach out to achieve a good character.
Fantastic.
And so, you know, there are so many movies, so many things based on good character. Now, I would just encourage us all to look for that, because we do get to choose, and we could be monsters. We don't, all of us know that we don't want to be, but yet how do we make that choice? How do we develop those habits? How do we surround ourselves with good books, good people, good circumstances? You know, show me your friends, I'll show you your future. You know, to be able to fortify our character so that we have the strength of character to be able to manage or resist the forces of culture. Because if we do not have the container of character, these forces will come upon us, whether it's money, fame, wealth, whatever it happens to be. And those forces will destroy us if we do not have the container of character required to resist them, to manage them.
Powerful statement. Now, if you were running for politics, the clip that would be taken from Dave Phillips seeking to be whatever would be, "We could be monsters." That would be it. That would be the tweet. Okay.
I would not make it 20 minutes in politics, John.
No, and he wouldn't do it. It's not as exciting as water skiing.
Jonathan, let's have your picks.
Well, I chose the classic, Aristotle's, you know, philosophy, Nicomachean Ethics. It's a classic. It's kind of the foundation. It's well written. It's an interesting read. For fiction, I picked a variety of things. For fiction, I thought of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, which is
amazing.
I mean, she's been picked up for, you know, as a feminist and things like that. But really, she's actually talking about moral virtue in terms of someone overcoming their pride and overcoming their prejudice. And it's a story, and stories are often good containers to carry moral virtue, which is why our mothers tell us these heroic tales and things like that. And faith stories tell us that. For a movie, I picked Bridge on the River Kwai.
Wow.
You know? And of course, I know your connection to that. So,
yeah. Well, I don't know if viewers will know that, so I'm going to jump in. So, my dad worked in Kanu 1 and Kanu 2, two villages just a stone's throw from the River Kwai, as a prisoner of war. And so, he had profound thoughts about that film, which is also in immortalized in the book by Pierre Bouillet, yeah, by a similar name. Interesting pick.
Yeah. And then a leadership book, I put one up there by Johnson. It's a text that I use to kind of give an overview of, and finally, the website I gave you, the VR Character Strengths and Reports, with Dave has also mentioned. It's fantastic, especially young people. You can come up with a fabulous iPhone wallpaper with your values. It's just great. They've done a fabulous, fantastic job, and an incredible gift to society. It's free to take it and to get a, you know, the preliminary thing. You can go and pay for other reports, but the initial one, it's free.
Well, you've both mentioned that several times, so you've persuaded me. So let's bring up my picks. Here are a few. Another book by David Brooks. This is called The Second Mountain. And what he says is that your first mountain is your resume, skills. And then he goes on to talk about your virtues or your character. Really interesting. It impacted me heavily, that book. I mentioned The Boys in the Boat, a fantastic story told beautifully by Daniel Brown about the grit, to use your word, Jonathan, of these nine Olympians, the eight oarsmen and the coxswain. And then I've mentioned at the beginning of the show this article that just came out last week by John Ibbotson, which talks about character in a politician. I think you would find that interesting. My favorite movie in the world, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's a 1930s film, black and white. It's about a guy who ends up unintentionally becoming a senator and then goes to Washington, D.C., expecting to promote character and leadership. And lo and behold, he runs into the impediments of corruption and vanity, and he just doesn't know how to deal with those things. It's a fantastic movie. When I was an MP, it was required viewing by my staff. And then here's Dave Phillips' book. You've seen it earlier, Three Big Questions. It's a really good how-to book on some of the specific things you can do to cultivate character. So I want to thank you both. A very cool traverse through discussions of character and how to build it and how to teach it and how to support it. Really, really appreciate each of you. Thank you for spending time with our audience and with me tonight. I remind you, folks, come back next month. Follow us on social media, of course, but there's also show we've got about women in leadership. I love your feedback, so let us know how we can do better. And thank you all for tuning in. Have a good evening.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you.